Welcome to From an Enfield Poet with me, Anthony Fisher. There will be a series of podcasts on poets, poetry, history and industry, most of which will have a connection with Enfield. All interesting topics for me that I hope will be of interest to you.
Enfield Industries podcast is supported by the Arts Council Place Partnership Initiative and administered by Enfield Council.
Tales of Enfield Industry looks at the manufacturing industry that grew up in Enfield. I'm Anthony Fisher and I've been making cleaning chemicals in Brimsdown since 1964. Join me for this four-part podcast series, hearing from people who have worked in the companies that grew up in the Enfield area.
A bit of a rebel, my dad. He was respectful, but management was management and workers were workers. Do you know, in the old-fashioned kind of feeling.
They lived in the park for about a week, Bushell Park. They lived in the park with me, actually outside. And the caretaker used to open the toilets to allow my mum to go in and wash me.
Old style English firm it was. We had the social club over there, a big building with the snooker, the darts and everything. So we used to socialise a lot. Went loads of trips.
In the final episode of my four-part series of Industry in Enfield, there are backstories from the 13 people that I interviewed. From those who travelled to make Enfield their home and place of work, to the blue and white collar divide, and the role that social clubs played within Enfield Industries.
An Anthony Fisher production, engineered by Maroon Community Media, celebrating Enfield's Festival of Industry.
Of more than 400 happy Jamaicans. They've come to seek work in Britain and are ready and willing to do any kind of job that will help the motherland along the road to prosperity. They're all full of hope for the future, so let's make them very welcome as they begin their new life over here.
Post-Second World War Britain had to rebuild its industries, which led to a call from people from the Commonwealth to help. Warren Grant has worked for Fisher Research Limited for about 18 years, and he tells me about his story and his mother's arrival from Jamaica.
My mum came here because they were always trying to get people from Jamaica to come here to do the jobs that other people wouldn't do. Yeah. So my mum was a very good dressmaker. So she came here, but she left me out there with my aunt, and she did say, I will get you over here with me when the time comes.
How long before you arrived had your mum been?
I think it was about 4 years.
Oh, so you're very young, absolutely.
I think it was about 4 years.
Who looked after you in Jamaica?
My aunt. My aunt was pretty well off, because it's like the Hollywood Hills where we were in Montego Bay. You had down in the town, and then you had the hills up where all the people, richer people live. Yeah. And I stayed, she left me with her, rather than down the town where her mum and all her other family were. She left me with her. So that was a good life, I remember, you know. But it changed, as I said, when I came here, and I knew it was going to be almost like an adventure, and it has been an adventure. I come by a plane, it was a VC-10, and they were supposed to be the best planes around at the time, and that always stuck in my mind. Yeah, that's how I got here.
You flew into Heathrow?
Yes, absolutely. I always remember when we left, you got the Smith Klein building. That always stuck in my mind as we drove past it, because you're that bit of the M4 where you can look at all those Glaxo or Smith Klein. It wasn't Glaxo, it was just Smith Klein then, but it was strange. But I was, in the funny, I was looking forward to it. First, it was nice to see my mother again, and as I said, it was going to be an adventure to me. That's how I looked at it. And I must admit, it's the best thing that ever happened to me. Dressmaker in Edmonton. In Edmonton, she was dressmaker right underneath the Edmonton Railway Bridge, just on the right hand side. She was working for a company called Peggy Page. They're not there anymore, because every time I go by, I have a look. The place is still there, but they're not Peggy Page. We were living Bruce Castle Road in Tottenham, right on Bruce Castle Park. I know Edmonton well because we used to go every Saturday to the baths, because we didn't have baths in our place where we live. Yeah. So every Saturday it was a journey to go up to the Edmonton baths to have a bath. That's how we did it.
Paul Pierce in episode 3 told us about his experience at Johnson Matthey and the health and safety concerns which workers faced, and how the dirty jobs were taken on by immigrant communities.
Italy, probably Jamaica. Yeah, generally not English people, and they used to do all the furnace work and things like that.
It must have been hot.
It was hot, yes, it was hot.
How did you all get on, the immigrants and the local people?
Okay, generally, yeah. It used to be like, yeah. Some of the electricians didn't, because some people, when they was in a plant and something went wrong, and they try and fix it themselves, they start pulling fuses out. Right. Which didn't go down too well with electricians.
So that wasn't because they were...
immigrants, no.
It was because they were doing something they shouldn't have been doing.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Mary Duggan was featured in the first episode and told us about her trade union activism to improve conditions for women workers. However, her family came from Ireland to address Mary's medical issues. She also told me about the family's first living conditions.
No, I'm Irish. Came over here, I think, about 1955 to... actually, the borders of Edmonton, Bushell Park, Edmonton borders. A bit homeless, actually, because I was a sick child and Great Ormond Street accepted to take me, so my parents were looking for somewhere to live and live with family members for a while. The family members had come over previous to that. And so they were in Enfield, and my mother was trained housekeeper and nanny, Dublin nanny. And so they lived in the park for about a week, Bushell Park. They lived in the park with me, actually outside. And the caretaker used to open the toilets to allow my mum to go in and wash me. Great Ormond Street was, you know, had accepted me because the Dublin hospital had let an operation fail. So they brought me straight over here to the best in the world.
Mary's parents had an entrepreneurial streak and looked for opportunities serving those that had worked in Enfield's industries.
That was a thriving shop. It was a little gold mine when my father and mother turned it into a newspaper and confections. And the people would stream out when the sirens went from a Ford.
So you could hear
across
the
line. You could hear the sirens. You knew that people would be coming out on their bicycles and flat caps, and you know, and women as well. Women worked there as well on the car factory, and they would come into the shop and they would buy the various, you know, tobacco and confectionery, and then we did cards and we did Triang, as I say. We got the Triang contract to sell things like that. So it was Christmases, it was interesting. He was very inventive, my father, quite an inventor, and he had made out of fake fur cut-offs that were left out at some factory or other, they noticed. He made tea cosies, and then they moved into making teddy bears with movable limbs, but the one thing they had that no other teddy bear or dog or rabbit had, and they did blue colours and yellow colours and grey colours and stuff, was a lullaby mechanism you wound up within the body of the animal, that a child could take to bed with it. And it was, you know, very, and he sold to places like Harrods as well. I mean, it was, you know, but the outworkers in Harlow, he had going, because my mum was very good at organising businesses. The outworkers started doing a lot of rejects, and in the end the business failed, so he went out and sold the rejects, and we had to sew up the ears. Like, as a child, I had to sew up the ears, put in the glass eyes and do all the stuff.
My mum worked in Sangamo Western, making aircraft instruments for aeroplanes, obviously. So they put it on a machine and tested it, and they had to be 100%, otherwise they'd chuck it out, and then you'd keep making them. She quite liked it there, I think.
Becky Coleman's family lived in Enfield. However, Becky tells us that living in a different part of the borough, assumptions were made.
That was interesting, because traditionally Eastern Enfield had a lot of manufacturing and a lot of people lived in Brimsdown, that area. I mean, did you feel, were you aware of the fact that you came from the more traditional area of Enfield, going from the west into the east?
They thought for some reason that I was posh, which I'm not posh at all. But if you'd have said, for instance, that you went to grammar school and got O-levels, they'd have thought you were crackers. You know, they weren't that sort of... I mean, they were nice enough, I'm not saying they weren't. But I did feel slightly different from them.
Did they know you had O-levels?
No.
Brother Windrush, I'm obliged to put to you an open question. Did you or did you not, in fact, collaborate with the management?
Me? Collaborate?
You silly...
In this historic period, the divide of class and blue and white collar jobs was prevalent. Mark Durham fondly tells us about his father.
A bit of a rebel, my dad. He was a little bit like, he was respectful, but management was management and workers were workers, you know, in the old-fashioned kind of feeling. So he would kind of, if there was a strike going on, I think he was a part of the union, but if there was a strike going on, he'd quite happily strike and have a go at management, really. Because I was involved as a manager quite early on, and he had that kind of thing saying to me, oh yeah, you're all typical manager kind of talk, you know? And I said, well, no, you've got to respect that. He said, no, you bloody haven't. He said, oh, you've got your own agenda and all this kind of stuff. So, but he wasn't belligerent as I'm making him sound. Yeah, he was kind of a bit of a rebel. He was a 1960s motorcyclist, rebel without a cause guy. So on with the Teddy Boys and everything. So he comes from that kind of feeling, you know, the youngsters kind of rebelling against society, really, although he wasn't that bad.
Social clubs were one way that factories could lessen the divide. Both Peggy Walker and Mike Chapman described their experiences, including sporting competitions with other companies in Enfield.
There was a social club which always surprised me, because, you know, they could go there and have a drink and then they'd be working on machines in the afternoon.
Again, the office staff and the factory staff didn't mix at all, or did they?
But on the whole, to a certain extent you did. I mean, you knew who they were, and if your job was going into the factory, you would know the fellas you were working with. But on the whole, they didn't... Really?
I used to play for the table tennis team against other companies, played chess against other companies, played badminton with Cliff Richard. Everybody, even if they didn't have a sports field or whatever, then they cleared the canteen out, made room for a table tennis table. And we used to play Enfield buses. They used to come in sometimes and say, I'm on shift now, can I play my three matches straight off, one after the other, so that I can go back on with you. Or the police, they used to do the same. So it was a good community, really. It was Ed Waska, which was Enfield Districts and Works, and I don't know what it is, but you had to be within a 10-mile radius, I think it was, of Palmer's Green. So the most you had to travel was 20 miles, basically, but a lot of it was down the Brimsdown area, cables, rolling mills.
We had a social club, everything. They had everything. It's a typical old-style English firm, it was. You had the social club over there, big building with your snooker, your darts and everything. So we used to socialise a lot. Went loads of trips. We went to Norway, things on cruise. We went Blackpool, we went everywhere. It was fantastic. I saw every show going back in the 90s, I saw every show. I didn't miss any. Phantom of the Opera, Les Miserables, all of them. I saw them all, and I love those sort of things. Because I was in the social club, and I organised it a lot, I got to know the people who sold the tickets. And so I used to be able to get tickets for like £10. Phantom of the Opera was costing massive amount of money back in the day. I got 30 tickets, £10 each. My favourite was a show called Five Guys Named Mo. Who's the talk of Rhythm Town? Five guys named Mo, that's us! Absolutely fantastic. It was like, it's like a singing and dancing thing, but the first three rows, which we were always in the best rows, we're sitting there and then the guy went, right, first three rows, up on the stage. What? Oh, I'm up on the stage. That's this cinema, this sphere, thousands of people, and we had to do a dance on the stage. Fantastic. Five Guys Named Mo. It was brilliant, that was. Five Guys Named Mo, that's us!
Warren Grant, with his memories of social clubs and activities.
The Girls at the Bench. Stayflex. Clavering Industrial Estate. Edmonton, N9. 1968-69. We four were the Girls at the Bench. Perched on high stools around a long bench in the research and development lab.
Enfield poet and good friend Christine Vial was featured in the first episode. Christine's family moved out of the East End for better housing and moved into a council flat off Bounces Road. One of Christine's first jobs was in Stayflex, as she eloquently describes in her poem Girls on the Bench. However, that she then meets the time and motion men.
I was the last one in, so it was obvious I'd be the first to go. Stayflex, which manufactured iron-on interlinings, that's the fabric that you use in collars and cuffs and lapels and so on to stiffen them. They had a factory in the Clavering Estate. Now, the reason I went to work there was very simple. It was really near my house. We were living on the council estate at the bottom of Bounces Road, and you could walk to this place in about sort of 10 minutes or something, because to earn some money. And it was really near, so that sounded convenient. Then came the time and motion men. There they were with their clipboards and their stopwatches, literally. It's not a surprise that after they had a look at us, they decided that we don't need four people to do this job. Three people will be sufficient. And fortunately for everybody, because I was the last one in, it was very easy to get rid of me. Clearly, you know, I should have gone because I was useless. But that's what happened, time and motion.
Throughout the series, we heard from many of the contributors as to how Brimsdown and Enfield Industries was a central part of their lives. These documentaries could not have happened without the importance of conversation and contributors' willingness to share their stories. I thank them with all of my heart. I'm finishing this final documentary with one of my poems. Conversations. We chatted, Humphrey and me, under the gnarled apple tree, him on the ground nearby, me in a chair with a G&T. All that moved was his neck and head, always unread, a book on my knee. He never told of what I said, I never spoke of his chatterings. Goose, man, together we sped and stretched our wondrous wings, flew high and far, everywhere. Could land in clouds, be kings if we wanted, or just stay there, dreaming in the darkening air.
An Anthony Fisher production, engineered by Maroon Community Media, celebrating Enfield's Festival of Industry. Enfield Industries podcast is supported by the Arts Council Place Partnership Initiative and administered by Enfield Council.
That's all from this episode of From an Enfield Poet. Thank you for listening, and I hope that you'll join me for the next episode.